So before I ask who's going to take notes, I need to indicate some changes that are going to happen going forward. After this class, so after the break, there will be a randomness system, which means that every day for class, I will have between, 3 to 5 questions that I'm going to ask, and I'm going to randomly choose who in the class needs to answer those questions, at least attempt to answer those questions. That list will be based on all the students in class, not just the ones who are here. So I will ask, I'll roll the dice, I'll call your name and say, okay, can you answer this question? The questions will not necessarily that hard, but I'm looking to see, are you here to answer the question? Now, you may go like, I really don't like that. I really don't want to have to worry about making sure I'm in class every time in order to be able to answer a question. There is a way out of it. It's called participating other ways. One way to get out of the list is to take notes. Okay? You take notes. If you don't take, another way to do it is potentially if you're already asking questions in class, it probably doesn't matter. You're already here. But if you're taking notes, that's one way, and potentially other ways is if you participate enough from the discussion forums and stuff like that. But I'm looking for, if you don't want to participate by answering things in class, that's fine, but then I should see other ways of you participating. Who wants to take notes? Actually, I want to designate 2 people, so both of you. So please email me LaFar afterwards. And those of you who have already been taking notes and stuff, you are definitely off the list. Okay?
Wait, so if we have taken notes, we're off the list?
Yeah.
So I don't have to come anywhere.
Yes?
Question, would we have some kind of forewarning what they might be so that we will be ready the next time in case you ask us?
Maybe, maybe not. I'm not concerned with you actually. I want you to try to answer the questions. I'm not going to grade you on whether you're right or not. The question is, are you here to actually try to answer it? Sometimes they want to actually get an honest answer. You don't know what it is.
Right. So, you just answered it.
Yeah. There's a chunk of your grade called 20% called participation. Participation is about showing up. And showing up is not about necessarily just being a warm body. It means participating. So that will start after the break. So you have a little time to prepare yourselves mentally. I want to spend a little time at the beginning of the class talking about assignment 2. Specifically, I will get assignment 2 done today. But I wanted to.
If we never get chosen for questions and we never take notes, how do you know if we participate or not?
That's a good question. That's a coverage issue. When you're talking about basically it's a Monte Carlo simulation, and what happens if I don't cover certain things? Well, you're just really lucky.
So if we do a probability analysis and decide that it's better off just staying home, we get marks.
It's still a participation.
Yeah, if you turn in a probability analysis, that actually is a participation. So. Okay, so regarding assignment 2, I want to ask you first, what topics do you think should be on it? Basically, what have we covered? I'm not saying I'm just going to cover what's put a question on there, but you have a chance to bias my question selection. And potentially what's on the... Oh, really? Do I only have yellow? I guess yellow is better than nothing, but... yellow. Okay. So, what have we covered since assignment one? Give me some comments. Okay, all of crypto, but you can't really talk that much. So. Specifically, when you say crypto, what in crypto? Because I certainly am not teaching a crypto class.
How it doesn't buy you too much security?
Well, what it can give you so certainly, one of the things I want you to be able to do when you come up into this class is not necessarily have a mastery of all crypto concepts, but to know, oh, I have a problem, I probably should look to cryptography to help me solve that, and some general, you know, thing. Okay, I can solve this part of it maybe with crypto, but if I do, I better worry about these things. So, I want you to know how deep a water are you in? Not necessarily teach you how to swim. So I just noticed the projector is in blank mode, which is kind of offends me. Yes, turn off the projector. There was it's a confirmation button. Okay. Okay, so what else?
Building software with security in mind.
So that's kind of the whole class.
Right. We talked about it a lot recently.
Yeah, right. But it, like, a little more specifically, I'm trying to think, like, get to more like a question by thing.
Yeah, obfuscation.
Okay, obfuscation.
Memory corruption.
Access control.
Well, that was kind of a little aside of one. Well, I was kind of, so that was
okay. Yeah, that's true.
Not to the no, that's okay. I'm behind you then.
Threat modeling.
Again, it's a little more beginning, but that's kind of an ongoing.
Certificates.
And this is a good, you know, start. Not everything, but certainly this is a lot of what we've been talking about. So now what I want to talk about is add a little bit to this. And if there's one thing on here that wasn't here, is a big theme for last time was talking about interpreters, or things that parse data, and the idea that whenever you have something that's parsing data, you have to make sure that the data that's given is okay. And if it's coming from an untrusted source, that data could do bad things. So, we talked about it in the context of memory corruption. So this is, you know, a C program is taking input. Now, standard memory corruption is just, okay, you didn't check your memory, you're sticking it in, you're corrupting it, and whatever. But format string vulnerabilities,
There's an interpreter in printf that if you allow an attacker to arbitrary control, they can do lots of nasty things. Then we talked about like SQL injection, which is, SQL for backend server. We talked maybe about shells, a little bit about that, but the idea is if you give a shell arbitrary things. This is in, if you want to process command line arguments, and instead of you parsing the command line arguments yourself, you give it to like a system command, and you stick user input into that command. You're basically having a shell parse that command line, and so it can call arbitrary shell code. So that's the thing, but probably the biggest exposed surface today in terms of you have interpreters that are parsing untrusted input. What is it? Big one.
SQL injections?
SQL injections definitely significant, but this I would argue is significantly bigger.
Browsers.
So browsers specific. So when you talk about SQL injection, what you're really talking about is there's an interpreter on the server, and you're sending a query to the backend database, and that query is not properly sanitized, so now you're giving the attacker control over the backend database. But if you're looking at modern web applications, the biggest exposed surface is really inside the browser itself. It's client side, not server side. And in the browser, what interpreters do we have?
JavaScript.
Well, we really have three. HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Now, really, they're kind of all twisted together and connected and things, but I mention them as distinct things because they each have their own syntax. And the syntax allows for, each of them has ways of being dynamic, although of course JavaScript's the most full-featured. But I think even CSS may be Turing complete. So there's, this is a big attack surface. What does it mean to exploit it? Because by default, this is all untrusted. Right? We talked about, putting bounds around things. And, we've got to designate what's the trusted and what's the untrusted. And normally, if this is in a box, that is untrusted, which is the web page. And so, okay, we're doing things, but it's in an untrusted environment, so how could this be dangerous? I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, a back-end database, okay, that's got to be trusted, that's got all your user data and stuff, but this is in the browser. I mean, maybe if there's something in here that allows you to escape the sandbox, that's one reason why, like, this Meltdown bug was so scary was because it was potentially allowing CPU flaws to escape from sandbox or at least be able to read data outside of it. I mean, that's like, I'm actually going to do that. But let's just assume the sandbox works. That in a browser context, you only have that stuff. So why is it dangerous?
Because the people writing those are lazy, and so they leave quite a bit of.
Well, they're always lazy. I mean, these programmers are lazy, of course.
Accepts user input.
Accepts user input, yes, but it's still untrusted, so.
Because you still have a bunch of things happening in the sandbox that can affect each other?
Much closer, yes.
It's Turing complete.
Again, it's untrusted, so. There are things, so that's the key idea, part of it. When you look at a modern web page, and you look what it is, okay, we have this page here, and what's on the page? Okay, let's say you browse us to a standard news site. You have your main content, right here, some text. But what else is on the page?
Huh?
Ads.
okay, you got some ads here, and then oh, maybe you have a Twitter feed there, and then maybe you have a little Facebook like button here or something, or, you know, and you have, you know, you might have a search box here from Google. You know, there's all kinds of stuff on there. All kinds of code. And each of those things are probably using JavaScript in some way on a modern page. Or is that JavaScript separated from the content? No. Everything, so this is one of the weird things about modern web pages, is yes, this is all a boundary, and to the host system, you know, to your, your, we'll say the host, it doesn't trust anything in there. So a lot of browser technologies are based on making sure the stuff inside here doesn't get out. But inside a page, it's almost like this multi-tenant environment, where you have all this code running in a shared context. I mean, they all have access to a global data structure, namely the document object model, which contains everything. Now, there are ways in which, okay, the code from Twitter is not supposed to be able to directly see the code from Google or something like that. There's a bit of, like, boxing up of things. But you can always just delete that part and replace it. Any code inside a web page can modify arbitrary things inside the web page. That's how it's all designed.
Have you heard of the tool, I think it's called AirPwn?
AirPwn.
Yeah, basically it does exactly that. While you're retrieving the web page from the server, it injects its own code into the page, which will probably look like what you're expecting, but it'll have like a little bit of underlying code where things are supposed to be.
So what this is taking advantage of is this is if you have an HTTP website. So it's not over TLS. So if it's not over TLS, the data can be modified in transit. And so you can, you know, change things. That's certainly a problem. That's not the main problem. The reason that's not the main problem is because most of this stuff here was invited. And the stuff that's invited is from all kinds of untrusted sources. And this is where things get, so sort of at a very basic level, you have to worry about, well, what if the JavaScript from this ad is malicious? Now, we have to define, what do we mean by malicious JavaScript? Well, what can you do here that would be damaging? Well, one thing you certainly could do is change the content of the page. So let's say Google said, you know, I really don't like all these negative articles on Google, the leadership rule says. I think we need to make it so that people don't see so many of those negative articles. So they modify their JavaScript, and that every time it does a little bit of sentiment analysis, simplistic, on web page, and says, oh, this is a negative page about Google. Let's rewrite it. So what it could do is, on the fly, just say, okay, let's just delete that, and then pull in a positive page. And even you may even use machine learning or something to adapt it or something like that, and they, of course, see this at scale and stuff. So they could literally rewrite the web on the fly. They have complete access to the web because their code is in most web pages. I mean, everyone's running Google Ads or running Google Analytics or something like that. So they've included JavaScript in the page. And that JavaScript could do anything. Why can't it go and mess with the text of any article? This is even separate from where they're hosting the web pages. AMP is something completely different. But this is just, it's running the web page. Why not just change it? And you might say, well, Google's doing, well, Facebook can do this now a lot too because their like buttons are all over the place. That's JavaScript. Twitter is all over the place too. It could modify a lot of things. I mean, it can modify the content. How you protect yourself from these things.
kind of hard. I mean, there's ways to potentially box your content away. It's supposed to put a little iframe and things like that, but a lot of this is doesn't want that protection. Oh, sorry, yes?
The add-on for Firefox NoScript, it turns off all JavaScript by default, and then you can kind of allow things back in as you want them and check things off.
Have you seen how much that breaks?
It breaks everything.
It breaks everything.
But you can turn back on stuff you want to work.
And the stuff you have to turn on is typically stuff that could be dangerous. I mean, see, the thing about this is not so much... Think of it like with set UID programs. It's not that you... It's how much do you have to trust? And the web right now is like... It's not like you're having a couple of set UID programs that you run occasionally. It's like you're doing everything as root. Everyone has access. It's like, okay, yeah, we can try to make sure you can't get on the system, but anyone who you allow in can do way too much. This is not something you heard about, talked about a lot, but I always kind of look at this going like, this is a bad one. But when you talk about web security, the people don't normally talk about this. Although I think this is one of the, like, it's one of those things that as long as everything is kind of going okay with the internet ecosystem, it's kind of okay. Because the publicity anyone would get from doing something like this could be so bad that, you know, they don't want to do it, but this does not make me feel good. But normally when we talk about web pages, they talk about security, they talk about the scripting, they talk about something else. And what they're talking about is content in here. Or content over here in the comment boxes. And what's the issue there?
Cross-site scripting.
So the term that's common is cross-site scripting. But let's put it in terminology that fits in what we're talking about. It's that you have untrusted input, namely random people tweeting away, appearing on this page. That's bits, that's being embedded in this page, which is based on a whole bunch of interpreted code. Why can't that take over the interpreter and then modify the page arbitrarily? I mean, if you were showing tweets, why couldn't one of those tweets all of a sudden change the entire page? Like, do what I was worrying about with Google doing? No, Google at least is a big organization, you could go after them. Just some random Twitter user starts sticking stuff in here. Have you heard about the SAMI attack? So this is back in the days of MySpace. You know, before Facebook, there was MySpace. So I'm trying to remember what the exact phrase was, but it was this funny thing that. So what would happen is if you visited this guy's page, if you saw that he was your friend, then it ran JavaScript that made you become his friend. And so it actually was viral because you would do it, you'd be our friend, then your page would show this friend adding code. So anyone who visited your page would now become this guy's friend. And then all of that person's friends would then become friends. So this guy just friends blew up. and Sammy is my hero.
Right here.
Is what
I think it was last year there was like a self-liking tweet that someone put out.
A self-liking tweet?
Self-liking or self-retweeting, but
self. Oh.
Yeah, it like spread the same way pretty much. Took Twitter like a day or two to patch it, I think.
These problems blow up in various viral ways, and then people have to deal with it. But that really, if it gets blown up like that, means really whoever was doing it wasn't being very careful, right? Because if you're kind of putting self-propagating code on there, the key thing is to make sure it doesn't propagate too far. You want to keep it quiet, because once it becomes noisy, people notice it and they stop it. I mean, that was the original Morse warning. It was supposed to spread around the internet quietly, visiting each machine one at a time. But the Morse worm had a bug, so it kept infecting the same systems over and over again, causing them to crash. If you're gonna make a worm, make it quiet. Otherwise, everyone's gonna stop it. And so the web is, you know, that wormable kind of thing is not the common case, but the thing is, anytime you are viewing user-generated content, which is almost always, like every Reddit thread you watch, you read, you know, or any comment section on any web page, or a tweet, there's always a possibility that inside that, in the comment, is code. And that code will change the page you're visiting arbitrarily. And that changing the page arbitrarily can actually be even more dangerous than you might expect, or something that we'll talk about in a second. But no, so you've got that's the cross-site scripting idea, is that I put I did something on one, this is why the terminology is just messed up, it's not even worth thinking about, but there's this cross-sites between different pages and stuff, but the idea that someone submitted something to a remote server and it got downloaded at another system and thus attacked it. And so the back-end server, in a sense, wasn't touched. It's serving as the carrier for the information between the attacker and the target. The attacker used one browser, and the target got their browser attacked. And of course, if you're putting stuff in here, and if there's a bug in your browser, of course, that code could maybe jump out of the sandbox and take over your system or whatever. That's certainly a possibility, but that's not the common case. Cross-site scripts, like, okay, yeah, now you're going to start liking things. Where cross-site script, where this sort of thing gets particularly nasty, is something known as cross-site request forgery. And these two, so it's often we think, okay, there's cross-site scripting, there's cross-site request forgery, but it doesn't. I hate this terminology. It's really all about running code. You're getting data, it's being given to an interpreter, and now you have to think about what the heck that interpreter is going to do with it. And this is just one of the games you can play once you start being able to insert things in a page. Although, technically speaking, you could do this by just having the victim visit a random web page. So cross-site request forgery could be just, okay, you just visit, you're looking at some blog or some news feed or something, you just click on a link at Slashdot or something. Does anyone here still read Slashdot? No, I don't think so. It's pretty dead. I still check. But you know, you go to some blog or something, you've got comments, and you see something that looks interesting. Oh, let me click on that link. So now you're visiting a malicious website. The attacker has control of it by one way or the other. What that attacker can do now is they don't just have a page in your web browser. They have the ability for your web browser to do lots of kinds of network traffic. And this is another part of this whole mixed thing. What determines what content is included in a page? The HTML JavaScript says. In other words, you can put in arbitrary things and say, oh, I would love to have that picture of a dinosaur from some random site and stick it into my page. I like it. Now, you could copy it, but then you'd actually have to pay the hosting costs and might add your bandwidth bill or something, so I'll just use their copy. So you just stick a link in and put it into your page. This is how the web was originally built. It's become less and less common because of how things are, but you can pull in arbitrary content from around the internet and stick it into any page. You might say, okay, that's kind of annoying, stealing my bandwidth, what's a big deal? But what if some of those requests went to your bank?
And one of those requests, say, like, was to send an interact e transfer. And you might go, wait, what? What are you talking about? How could you send an interact e transfer? Well, what it does interact e transfer look like to the backend server? It looks like a set of messages, a set of HTTP requests. And how does it know you are who you say you are? Well, you have to log in and authenticate. But then after you've authenticated, how does it know it's you? Cookies. So when we say a cookie is just some bit of data that was stored, you know, host A, B, so all these are different websites. They all have their data stored in your web browser. And this data is given back to the specific website. So like if you visit your bank, and if it sets cookies, those are stored here, and they will only be sent to the banking website. So an attacker says, oh, well, I'm safe. The attacker can't get at my cookie. Now, certainly, the attacker can grab these things. They basically can often have authentication tokens to get into a site you're visiting. So that's, but that's a browser vulnerability. The browser's not supposed to do that. But the browser is supposed to give the cookie to the destination host. So now the attacker is saying, oh, wait, why don't you visit TD? And when your browser goes and accesses TD, it will naturally send TD its cookies. So we'll say, oh, look, you're logged in. Oh, sure, you can do that transfer. Now, of course, most of these places have protections against this, but what do those protections look like? Anyone know?
You always have to re-enter your password.
You have to keep re-entering your password. You can't stay logged in for very long. This is why you can't, this is part of the reason why you can't stay logged in for very long into any, you know, site like that. It's because they worry about this sort of thing. About random, you know, you visiting other pages and all of a sudden them sending messages and doing all kinds of shenanigans. But you think of other websites, they let you stay logged in for a long time. Like if you visit Amazon, you stay logged in for a long time. But the moment you check out, the moment you actually make a purchase, it mostly asks for your password. Unless you've turned on one-click ordering.
Which I'm going to go turn off after class.
And then it's, you know, it's, now of course, so places like Amazon, they have a lot of security stuff going on. But their security stuff is going on server side. Because it turns out, if you, one of the ways that this is stopped is whenever you visit a page, you follow a link, there's a refer link that says where this came from. And there's also an origin link which says, now that's a newer thing, says what domain it came from. Those are to tell the, who sent this link? What kind of page did this come from? I mean, and you know, a bank would say, well, I'm only going to let banking things happen if the things came from actually came from my pages. They came from TD.com, okay, we'll trust it. They came from some other random domain? No, we're not going to listen to that. So Amazon has protections like that on the server side to do that. Do you think everyone has those protections? Think everyone does this all right? Do you think they always get it right all the time? There aren't ways to get around it? Yeah. That's a vulnerability.
Could you change those fields anyway? Like if Amazon's like, we only accept if it refers from Amazon. The referrer is something that you control, isn't it?
No, you don't. That browser sets the referrer field. So this is how you track inbound links. Well, like when someone visits your page, how did they get here? And if you clicked on a link in a search engine, when it shows up on your blog, you look at your log, you'll see, oh, look, someone's visiting this, and they came here from Google. Or they came here from Bing. Or they came here from, you know, this other blog that linked to it. You can do all this analytics. And that's coming from the browser itself.
Yep.
Although, I mean, the reason why sites like to know about search engine, those links, is because then that lets them say, okay, where's my traffic coming from? But that also can aid in sites tracking you across the internet and watching, you know, your finger footprints.
This might be just an implementation deal, but does opening in a new tab retain the refer link?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it does. Now, if you turn on, now modern browsers start having things like, you know, incognito and private browsing mode, and they have ways of like referral links. This is actively changing because various folks are going, maybe you shouldn't be tracked so much. But it's a little, some of the stuff that's used for tracking is also used for security to prevent things like cross-site requests for people. Like, where did you come from? Are you, is that where I expect you to be? If you strip all that out, then you can't tell.
Also, when they were designing this, they didn't expect people to be able to store large amounts of data forever.
Right.
So.
Well, but this isn't large amounts of data. The cookies are actually just tokens.
Yeah, but I mean, if they're tracking everyone everywhere.
Right.
Right, so they're like, oh, wait, now we can do that.
Yeah, but the web was not designed. The web evolved. People built little bits of technology, and then people then go like, oh, that's really interesting technology. What can I do with that? And they go, oh, what can I do with that? So you all know about how modern web pages allow for processing the background. So like, you know, you sit there, you're reading Gmail and stuff, and it just automatically gets refreshed, and then you hit send, you send an email, it'll send in the background, you can keep doing stuff. That wasn't how old web pages worked. It used to be like if you did email on in a browser, it was really bad because every time you did any operation, it had to go get a new page from the server. So click, basically each click would be the equivalent of a refresh. And that makes it really slow and clunky. But this little thing was, you know, was bad. And so it's the technology ended up being this thing called XML HTTP request. You know who developed that first?
Microsoft.
Do you know who is most scared of the browser taking over, you know, making desktop-like applications? Microsoft. Do you know why Microsoft did this? Do you know how they did this?
In another context?
Wasn't it that they made Internet Explorer the default shell for Windows?
No, it's not Internet Explorer quite, although they did use Internet Explorer technologies to do this. Outlook Web Access. They were building a web client for Outlook. And they were going, ugh, this sucks. So they had this idea of creating an ActiveX control. If you remember ActiveX controls, they were Windows code that you would download from the web. That would run as full Windows code. Dumbest idea ever. But it did allow you to extend functionality. I mean, the only way you'd get protection of ActiveX was it was properly signed. Not enough protection. But what Microsoft did was create an ActiveX control that extended Internet Explorer that enabled this XML HTTP request method, which allowed for background processing in a web page. And then what do the other browsers do? They go like, wow, that's a really useful API. Instead of requiring an ActiveX control to enable it, we'll just build it in. And everyone did. And then Google came along and said, let's make Google Maps. I think that was like one of the, like Google, it was Gmail and Google Maps, both came, I think, but they both kind of created these like, look at the cool things we can do in a modern web browser. And people went, what'd you just do? That's crazy pants. Oh my God, I can do it. And then everyone started doing it, and that's what started off the kind of the modern browsers really becoming all these powerful, you know, computing engines. But it all started with Microsoft, one team at Microsoft making one little choice of saying, wouldn't it be nice to have this little extra bit of functionality? And then it's spreading through the ecosystem. And that's how all web things really happen. People think, oh yeah, there's a standardization body and there's other things. Yes, they have influence. But it's really what people want to do with the web is where the web goes. And that has really interesting consequences for security. I mean, the modern web security is what it is because the web, the architecture of the web in terms of security really wasn't thought about. And so people started using it for much more high value things than was ever anticipated for, and wanting to have functionality that was much more powerful than people planned. I mean, the web was supposed to be this document exchange platform, not a platform for running arbitrary mobile code. So it's a mess. So the you know how you test this? So MediaWiki. So any sort of wiki or any sort of blog thing, can you normally, or even in a Facebook post or tweet, can you embed arbitrary HTML in your content? In general, no. Some places say, okay, you can embed a little bit of HTML content. We'll say, okay, you can do add an A tag, and maybe you can do boldface, and maybe you can do a couple of the little things. So what that means is on the back end, they're taking the input from the user and using some sort of parsing, maybe a whole bunch of really ugly regular expressions that are parsing through the input and trying to make sure that nothing bad is there. On the other hand, you have things like, okay, let's give you a completely different language. Like MediaWiki is, well, MediaWiki is kind of both, but other things like you don't type in HTML, you type in another language. And then that gets translated to HTML. And the translation, it automatically escapes anything that could be interpreted as HTML. These are kind of the two strategies. Either you filter out the bad things, or you make sure, or you escape everything so you know that everything is going to be safe. Generally, I would say the filtering everything as opposed to just finding the bad things is safer. But people do all this. But how do you make sure that everyone does it properly? How many of you have done much web programming? All of you have taken 24/6, right?
Yeah. With you?
Hmm? Yeah, okay. So you've all taken 24/6. You've all kind of seen some web stuff here, so this isn't completely unfamiliar. I'm trying to think of what piece I have to talk about here. Okay, I can talk about that. So we can bring an arbitrary content into here. Is that a good idea? Not really. If you're making a web page, you don't necessarily want arbitrary content in there, because if you had made a mistake in your parsing thing, someone could put a comment on your web page and all of a sudden now you're getting images or JavaScript or something from some random website being added into your page. And doing who knows what. All of a sudden now your web page is a crypto mine, you know, a cryptocurrency miner. You don't want that. What would a solution? So one way to fix this is to filter it and try to make sure the problem doesn't happen. But you're gonna make mistakes. So what is another strategy we could use to make sure that, yeah, so let's assume that code will be injected into the page. How are we gonna prevent it from doing damage? Or minimize the damage it can do? What do we need? What's the general principle we want? Least privilege. We want to minimize the privileges. So that really means we need some sort of access control mechanism. We need your way of describing who is allowed to run code inside of this web page, as opposed to saying anyone who gets code in there is allowed to do it. We need a way of saying no. What sort of access, on what basis would we have access control? What are the entities? that people want to have permissions on the level of. It's not users, right? We can't actually talk about who supplied these content in here.
Maybe like just blocks of JavaScript code.
Right, but the attack we're trying to prevent is if JavaScript code's getting inserted into this page arbitrarily.
Don't you have to like break up the DOM and sort of create like virtual DOMs that only, right, so you'd only have access, if you had like an ad or something and you got into that, you'd only be able to modify inside that mini DOM?
So one of the ways is, wouldn't it be nice to partition up this page so that you have different privilege levels inside different parts of the page, right? So mini DOMs.
But then that falls apart once you get like CSS in there, because you can just move it to wherever you want it.
Yeah. Exactly, yes. So it's not just, okay, you can say this portion is only allowed to do this, but that, okay, someone was over here, but now it gets moved over there, and now it's overlapping it, so what's the point of that? I mean, so certainly, but maybe some sort of encapsulation. Encapsulation spatially may have some use, but there's something more fundamental we need to encapsulate and control access from. It's where it came from, the origin. Traditional web pages have a restriction known as same origin policy. In newer systems, there's a thing called CORS, C-O-R-S, I think. Cross-origin, I forget what it stands for, but originally it was, if you downloaded code from a website, if you have JavaScript code running in the web page, the only remote server it can access is the origin server. That was the idea. But of course, this had always exceptions because, okay, maybe your code can't do that, but you still could incorporate images and text, or I think, from arbitrary places. But the code itself should only be talking to the origin server. What I'm talking about here is having something a little more explicit of saying, you can only get content from these places. You can't load images from arbitrary places. You have to load images from one of these three domains. You're going to load JavaScript, you're going to load it from here. If you're going to load other text, it's going to come from here. This is, it's a whitelist approach of what is allowed and associated privileges with each. This exists in modern web browsers. It's called CSP, Content Security Policy. Although I don't know how, but it's not really used as much as it should be. But the idea of CSP is that it allows you to specify for your page where can content come from. One of the consequences of using CSP is you also essentially get rid of inline scripts. You can call JavaScript, but your JavaScript code kind of has to come from a separate file, and that separate file will be under CSP policy. So you know where it came from and you can give rules.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that sort of fall apart as soon as you get into user-generated content? Like if you're looking at a link sharing site, like Reddit or something, like there's no way they could ever...
No. Well, so a link sharing... So it's one thing to have a link that takes you another web page. This doesn't prevent that. This is saying... Well, though I think you might be able to have something like that, but this is more about what can be incorporated as content into that page. If you click on a link, you're going to another page. Okay, that's a whole different, context. But within this page, as opposed to saying, okay, I'm just going to download JavaScript into this page. I'm going to include a script tag, which will access this page, and just now I have code inside this page. That's what this is preventing. This essentially would say, oh, you have a script tag, a script tag that's accessing, domain foo.com. Foo.com's not on the whitelist, so we can't download any code from there. So what content security policy does is it prevents stuff from coming from arbitrary places. If you are on the trusted list, it does not prevent you from messing with others on the trusted list. And those others on the trusted list are potentially not mutually trusted. Facebook doesn't necessarily trust Google, but they have to share. So that CSP doesn't help with that, but it does help with, let's make sure not some random domain doesn't have content included in this.
Would there be any kind of way that an attacker could somehow be on the trusted list? Like somehow?
Very much so. You think no one can mess with Facebook or what it provides to a page? Or Twitter in particular, like a Twitter feed or something? I mean, being on the trusted list does not mean that you are trustworthy. It means that you are trusted, which means you are giving them the power to screw you over, not the saying that they will, they won't definitely screw you over. There's a key difference. And certainly wouldn't it be nice to kind of say, I'd have a little more fine-grained control, there's proposals and other things. I had a PhD student who wrote a dissertation on ways to try to limit access to specific boxes and stuff. It's called security style sheets. Was her proposal, so to Terry Oda, if you want to look it up. I think there may be some stuff that's kind of related that's kind of percolating out their standards, although I haven't really seen the latest stuff what she did work like 6-7 years ago. So, but God, time flies. but I haven't seen any. I mean, all I see now is more evidence of making this more permissive, because they actually want to make web pages more and more powerful. And incorporate more and more content from more and more, making it arbitrary code runtimes. And there is some consideration of security, but again, people always are first focused on functionality. So it's still a bit of a mess. But notice the pattern here. The issues that we're talking about, these concerns here, are not really that different from, say, running a Linux system. I mean, you're talking about where can, or the running a Windows system, it's like, where can you download code from? How much access does that code have? Maybe I should set up, I want to limit the access this has, I should have some sort of boundaries. And maybe I should have some access control language to be able to say what access is allowed for these things. It's the same thing. There's a reason why a lot of people start talking about modern browsers as the modern operating system. Because it's doing much of the things that operating systems classically do. It's running code and managing resources and implementing security guarantees and stuff. That's what the browser is. But its model is not what a modern operating system is. And that actually has a lot of advantages. Because the web started with, first off, okay, we're downloading stuff from untrusted sources. We're running code, so we're going to run code, but it's going to be sandboxed. And the problems with the web really come from, okay, we've sandboxed this from the rest of the world, but now actually the rest of the world is mixing inside of one web page. That wasn't something that was not anticipated. So the web is better off than code running on a classic operating system, but it then has its own unique problems. When this sort of model came to other platforms, the issues with it coming to other platforms, operating systems changed. You know what I'm talking about, how operating system changed? So what's a modern system where you're downloading code from arbitrary sources and running it not as inside a web page, but running on a full computer?
Maybe like one of those websites like LeetCode or something?
I'm saying separate from the web.
Oh.
But very, very common.
Is your phone?
It's your phone. Phone operating systems, Android and iOS, are kind of dealing with a similar threat model in many ways to the web. You have arbitrary content providers that are running, that want to run code on your system. Now, the difference is instead of visiting a website, you install an application. But installing, and there's But there's also this thing of, okay, I'm installing an application, it should be fine. On iOS, we install an application, it's that, oh, Apple allowed it in the App Store, so it's probably okay. Originally, Google was, we don't know, it's gonna ask for permissions, you have to decide whether you trust it or not. But increasingly, Google is now doing things of actually having to stand by it, saying, okay, no, stuff in our store is safe, you can install it, it'll be fine. And they've implemented security policies to back that up. But we're still in the same space of, okay, I'm downloading stuff, I'm running code, I need to restrict its access, it's going to be able to access the internet, it's going to be able to access my local system. What do I do? Because you know, if you look at web pages, what's the other thing that's happened with modern web pages? They get more and more access to your local system. Like they ask things like, could we share your location information with the remote server? Could we give access to your microphone or webcam to this remote, you know, to this website? There's all this access out. Can I access your file system? You know, these are things not really that different with when you talk about mobile applications. What's the security strategy that mobile applications have taken? Really, it's two. They're two very different strategies. There's the iOS strategy and there's the Android strategy. Anyone know what the iOS strategy is? Sandbox the crap out of apps. Isolate them. Treat them like web pages. Basically treat them as, you're untrusted. You can't do anything. We're gonna give you a little environment. Inside they're gonna do stuff, but you can't see anyone else's stuff. You can't touch anyone else's stuff and everything. That was the original model, and over time, Apple has punched holes in it in order to allow access to other things. But the number of holes is still relatively small and very controlled. You have to use specific APIs to escape, and what you can do as part of that escape is very limited. Like, oh, you can now add actions to a menu, but you can only add certain actions. It's limited. So sandboxed, limited access. When you want to access certain things, you're going to have to ask the user. Say, I want location access. So you get a little pop-up saying, you want location access? Yes, no. I want to access the microphone? Yes, no. It's very much like the web, in a sense. It's kind of analogous. That's not Android. What's the Android model? Access control, exactly. Basically a capabilities list. It's very much like the Linux kernel kind of thing, except they come up with their own set of permissions and saying, you install an application, you want, you know, your application should have a manifest of saying what permissions it wants to install. You know, it wants to run. So it's like, okay, there's 100 privileges or something, I want these 20 privileges. And when you install the application, it says, the application would like these privileges, yes or no? And you're supposed to look at those and kind of go, should I give that application those privileges? Okay, sure, I'll trust you for that. And it's installed, and the application has those privileges.
I think since Android 7, it then has to ask you what it wants to use.
For a few things. Not everything. There's hundreds of permissions in that. Android does not ask you hundreds of things. They ask you things that look like the things Apple asks you about, i.e. location information and microphone access and other things. Right? It does do a little bit now of that prompting. That was not the original thing. Once an application got it, it got full access. It was trusted to have that. And you had to decide at install time. And you did not have the option of selectively denying an application. Say, I'll install you, but I'll only give you these privileges. Newer versions of Android do let you do some selective modification of permissions. Although a lot of apps will still be very unhappy if you take away some of their permissions. They'll just crash. But so in effect, Apple went with a model that was much more based on how we do the web, which is that the code is fundamentally untrusted. So we're going to isolate it. and maybe allow it to do certain things, but there can be very context-specific trust decisions that can be revisited at any time and changed. And try to give indicators of, oh, look, some background application is accessing their location, so we have a little icon here showing that someone's accessing their location in the background. Android had much more of an OS-type model. It's really taking the kind of classic operating system privileges and just making them much more fine-grained. And the problem with really fine-grained permissions is no one understands them, no one sets them right, everyone just goes, oh, you know, what's the class thing a developer is going to do? My application isn't working because I don't have enough privileges. You know what I'm going to do? Give me all of them. Or just give me lots of them. Please, please, I want this. And he's like, oh, my app works. Hey, I'm done. You know, that's a classic developer. Or then, you know, there's the malicious folks that kind of can ask for lots of privileges. And then you have the user going like, what does this mean? In effect, with Android, traditionally, you would have to do a security analysis every time you installed an app. I remember when I used to run Android more, I would like, I'm going to install this little memo app. I just want something for doing, you know, like little memos, just a little text document. And I remember there was like these apps that go like, oh, it wants location access, it wants access to my microphone, it wants access. Like, what? Say, no. I don't want to, I mean, it's not even a multimedia one. But why do you want all those permissions? A lot of times those things want those permissions because they want it for their ad thing. But then if you look through it and you go like, oh, look, requires no extra permissions. They do exist. You get that. It's like, okay, now I'm happy. But I had to hunt for these things. And that was just such a pain. But you have to do that. You have to do that security analysis. And most users don't have a clue. Even if they might be concerned about certain things. Are they going to be able to parse through? I mean, yes, they've made it more user-friendly over time for you to do things. It's like when you download an arbitrary program onto a regular operating system and decide whether it's trustworthy or not. Can you decide? No. At least it has all these permissions so you have an idea of what it acts as it wants as opposed to a program that can do anything it wants. But that doesn't really.
Now, in order to do certain things, they need permissions that might look strange, right?
Yeah. Well, this is the security analysis is not trivial because it really depends on the purpose of the app. I mean, if you're going to install an app which is going to, say, be, you know, you're going to do some sort of security monitoring or maybe do some, you know, help you find your phone or something when it gets lost or something, it may need more access than another app. But how do you know that? I mean, it's a sophisticated level of analysis. And I think it's very telling what one came out of Google and one came out of Apple. So, yes, Linda?
My memo app has a permission to call. Because, I know, I was nervous. Because it wants the ability for you to click on a phone number inside a memo to call. And I was just.
It's like
it just adds features and gets privileges.
More features, more privileges, and each feature seems all reasonable, and then you realize, oh, that feature will be used for something else.
Because Android apps aren't locked in their own environment, could an Android app that's malicious potentially leak privileges from another app who has those privileges?
Yep. There's a whole little body of research in the security literature on like how an attacker can divide up their attack and not, instead of having just one app that does the bad thing, they have like three or four apps and one of them asks for these permissions, one of them asks for these permissions, one of these asks for permissions, and they collaborate together and then. But that's it, and what's hilarious about this is it's exactly the same kind of threats that when we talk about access control systems, we talk about mandatory access controls and talk about intelligence agencies and people wanting to share secrets and try to leak them out. They do the same kind of tricks to get around it.
I mean, at the same point, like, does at some point some of the responsibility would not, that falls on the user, right? Like, if you're downloading a memo app that wants to take your camera location and like has like a grocery list of things, like, that's your own fault, right? Like, if you go buy a chainsaw.
But that assumes that,
like,
So that assumed that the end user can or should be able to do the security analysis.
Right, but if you look at like a table saw, like I can go buy a table saw. I have no idea how to
but
use
the,
it.
The table saw has natural affordances, which we understand. It's like, oh, it's sharp. It spins. I've seen sharp, spinny things that hurt. I don't want it. Well, I know sharp things. I know spinny things. And I you know not to put your hand near it. At least once you're past the age of two. You know, you understand these things about the world. Maybe, you know, today people are learning this sort of thing, but the kind of problems that you run into with these things will all be very quiet. It's like, oh, everything from your phone has been sent out to the internet, and they're watching these. Like, how do you know? I mean, I'm a designated expert in this field, and if I look at an app, I have to think before I can make a decision. It's not an obvious thing.
It's sort of the same thing as getting people to read license agreements.
Yes.
Most people don't bother.
Most people don't bother, but there's a good reason not to, actually, because it's like those actually haven't really been tested in court. And you can say no one reads these things. It's like, then you get other case law that would make the decision whether this was reasonable or not. Those contracts are ridiculous.
Plus, you also have to find a competitor that does it with less privileges.
Right.
So
the position Apple took with their App Store was saying, we're not going to depend upon users making a general security analysis. We know that users can maybe make certain kind of decisions, like for their privacy of liking. Do you want this app to know where you are? Do you want this app to know to access your camera? Do you want this app to use your microphone? I mean, those are things that people have some notion of. Even that's still not perfect.
Well, so especially when they're doing it, right?
And also when they're doing it, it's in the context of the event. Don't realize that now they've given this program complete control of everything. And again, it's like people have a task. Security is always a secondary task. And we have this problem of evolution. It's like Unix was designed in an environment where everyone using it was fundamentally a developer. It was designed as a big integrated development environment. That's what the command line's for. So this notion of if a person runs a program, it can do whatever that user's ability to do, you know, has full permission, make it has access to all the user's files, can make network connections to that user, that makes sense. But in a world where the people who run the code are not the people who develop the code, that doesn't make sense. So modern Linux distributions are now trying to take a page from this and trying to say, maybe we should adapt this way too. But how is that adaptation happening? Anyone know what the modern development of that is? Have you all heard of Snaps and Flatpak? So, you know. It might be Flatpak. I don't know how they spell it. Maybe P-A-C-K would put it, but. So if you look these up, what they are is they're standards for packaging up Linux applications to run on drawn systems. I mean, so this is supposed to be a not a distribution dependent thing. So it's supposed to include all of its dependencies in it. So you can install it on any Linux system that supports this. As opposed to saying, oh, here's the Debian Ubuntu version, here's the Red Hat Fedora version, here's the Gentoo version. I've got all these versions, you have these. As part of these packaging formats, they also include sandboxing. Various ways of limiting it. But if you one way now, if you want to run Skype on your Linux distribution, you can get a snap for it and install it. And install is really nice. And the nice thing is once you install it, it automatically updates. But to install it, you have to install it in quote-unquote classic mode. I really wanted to shoot them when I saw this. Do you know what classic mode is for snaps? It's a regular app, unsandboxed. It's like, okay, so I have to install it. So I thought I was supposed to be sandboxing this, but that was better. Why does Skype need arbitrary access to my system? Why does Skype need to see any of my files? Maybe I guess so it can upload files, maybe, or something, but then shouldn't there be some protected way or something? I was like, no. It's like, but again, it's like, okay, you install the program on your system. It's trusted. I can't audit all that. So, to your question?
No.
So what I'm trying to get at here is trying to tie in the stuff we talked earlier about access control. We talked some of it about isolation and things. I'm just saying these things are all over the place. And what it all comes down to is you have an environment where you can run code. And that environment is going to be an environment that can run code and it has data in that you're going to put into it. And the data that goes in there, or the programs that go in there, may or may not be trusted. And how are you going to make sure that you're going to have some amount of safety? And the way you do it is by setting up access controls, by setting up sandboxing and stuff. And typically, the way you go between access controls and sandboxing is if you use sandboxing, and you say, I don't trust this at all. And you use access control, well, I do trust it to some degree, and I'm going to articulate the ways in which I trust it. And in practice, the line between the two is not firm, because whenever you sandbox things, you almost never want to completely isolate it. And sometimes when you give access control, you want to put minimal privileges on it. So it's a continuum. And then there's the question of who gets to decide what permission something gets. There's always the end user has to be part of it, but how empowered and how knowledgeable is an end user in making those kind of decisions? Because to make those decisions properly requires some sort of security analysis. And people can make security analyses to some degree in certain contexts. Now, if you see your friend walking down the hallway towards you, and they're your best friend, you've authenticated, it's fine. If they're carrying a bloody axe and with a murder clean, you're not necessarily going to walk up and shake your hand. That's a threat assessment. That's a security decision. People can do this. People have a sense of survival. They have their own goals. But they can't do this at arbitrary granularity in arbitrary context and do it for times that are not based on their current task. So one, this all ties into usability of security systems. You can't think about these questions without thinking about who's making the decisions and in what context and with what background knowledge. It's not saying that the users are dumb. No. It's not saying developers are dumb. No, but decisions have to be made. And where do software vulnerabilities fit into this? It's like, okay, we set up all these nice rules for how things should work, and the rules can be bypassed. And I think we're about out of time. So if you have questions, let me know. I think I have a few minutes here to talk right now, and then enjoy your break. Assignment 2 will go up later today, and you have 2 weeks.
So I got a Yuba key, but unfortunately,